Okay, we continue in our series on romanticizing life. And tonight I want to look at manhood, how manhood is romanticized. How important is it, do you think, to have a correct understanding of manhood? Why would it be important?
We are created in the image of God.
Okay, we're created in God's image.
And He gives us specific instructions on what we need to do.
Specific instructions are giving about what we need to do.
Providing so much leadership, it's just a matter of then where we're...
We're providing a huge amount of leadership, and where are we going to be leading? Dominion. So we can see that manhood, the concept and the idea and the purpose of manhood, has a significant role to play in the outworking of God's purposes. It's a key role, in fact. Now, every person in the kingdom of God is significant and has purpose. However, because of God's ordering and ordaining the authority structures and the responsibilities of leadership and placing that upon men, you suddenly realize how significant their role is in the whole outworking of God's plans. Yet we're constantly bombarded with another image of what manhood looks like. I mean, if you had to just sit down and say, okay, what is my image of manhood that I'm getting from the world wherever I turn? It's the carefree, easy living, self-serving, do what feels good goal. That's the concept that is paraded before our eyes all the time. This false image which comes to us from the world and our flesh and portrays liberty and freedom as doing whatever your whim desires. That's what the real man is. The guy who can just up on his whim and fulfill whatever desire he wants. That's the person who's attained genuine manhood. So the real man is presented to us as being carefree in his responsibilities and being able to entertain himself for the majority of the time. He has to work, and that's acknowledged, and people kind of condescendingly accept that fact. But the real goal is that this work is done quickly and easily, and it's breezed over, and then he can focus upon that which his whims desire, that which his flesh wants to pursue. So he can entertain himself with those. Whether people are trying to sell you the latest version of Microsoft Office or the latest SUV, they're presented in those same kinds of terms. You'll be confronted with this common perspective of manhood as this freedom from responsibilities and freedom to do what you want to do. This is not only romanticism, it's a romanticizing what manhood is. It's also undermining the kingdom view of manhood. When I was growing up, I had a friend, and I'm guessing, I can't really remember. He was about 10. We were both around 10 at the stage. He couldn't wait to grow up so that he could drink and smoke and drive a fast car. Those were his goals. He said, no, this is what I want to do. I want this liberty. I want this freedom. I want this ability to do this stuff. Now, you might not have these same things in your sights, but many times our goals are as frivolous and self-serving. I want to attain manhood, or I want to use my manhood toward this end, towards this goal. What are the characteristics of biblical manhood? What things need to shape our thinking and be kept in the forefront of our eyes? What are the things that we need to be aiming at and striving toward? And if we're not aiming at something, if we don't have a concept in our minds as, okay, this is what manhood is, if we don't have that established in our minds according to the scriptures, we will be swept along by the common mindset of our day. If we're not aiming at God's definition of what true manhood is, then we're going to hit a distorted version of manhood. We're going to have something in our minds, and we'll be pursuing that. When you have a correct perception of what manhood entails, of what it looks like, then your expectations will be instructed, and your mental and physical commitment to that ideal will be enhanced, will be strengthened. I understand what it is, I'm going to commit myself physically toward that, mentally, emotionally. You know, you can only do what you see. If you can't see something, you don't do it. Comes down to, if you don't notice something's a mess, you won't do anything about it. But it applies to every area. If you can't see it, you won't do it. You can only do what you understand and believe in. So you cannot endure difficulties if you do not believe that there's a purpose in enduring these difficulties. If the goal is not worthwhile to be reached at the end, there's no purpose for the struggle. One of the main aspects of biblical manhood is self-sacrifice. It is self-sacrificial leadership. But how do you endure the discomfort of sacrificing self if you don't understand the significance of this for the kingdom? How significant is self-sacrifice for the kingdom? If you don't believe there's a connection, if you don't see the significance and the fundamental part of self-sacrifice to the kingdom advancement, then you can't see it and therefore you won't do it. How do you deny yourself and your own desires in order to example Christ-likeness? You can't if you don't believe that such things are integral to the working of God's kingdom. How do you live like this in a world that portrays a completely opposite view of manhood? It floats before our eyes a kind of manhood that is self-serving and expects others to serve you. That's the kind of manhood you have. Others running around you, whether it's pretty ladies feeding you grapes or whatever it is. Those are the images that are bombarded. This is the image of ultimate manhood. But this is diametrically opposed to biblical manhood and thus opposed to effectively impacting others for the kingdom. Opposed to impacting what is fundamentally good and making something worthwhile. You think about the impact of David's example of self-sacrifice, of self-sacrificial leadership upon those around him. And you see his example manifested in the kind of men that attached themselves to him and the kind of exploits that they endured and undertook. So David's example has to be regarded as a significant contributor to the mighty exploits of the men that followed him. David had led in the area of denying himself and sacrificing himself, and a host of these men that rose up around him did the same. You can read about that. Great chapter to read is 2 Samuel 23, which shows the men that attached themselves to David, and it talks in that chapter about their exploits. We're told that one man, he killed 800 people at one time. 800? How do you fathom that? Another one, Eliezer, was fighting and the Israelites withdrew, retreated, and he stood and faced the Philistine army on his own. And he slew them until, they say, the sword was stuck to his hand. I believe there was cramp and blood. I believe that must have just been quite a gooey mess, whether it was his own blood and the blood of his enemies, but that was now caked. He'd been fighting for so long, it was glued to his hand. You get people who do that. And the Lord wrought a great victory at his hand. When they were besieging Bethlehem at one stage, the Philistines were occupying Bethlehem, and David said, "Man, I'd love a drink of water from the well in Bethlehem." And three of his mighty men, they burst into that, broke through the barricades, got in there, got him some water and brought it back. And David was so humbled, he took that water and he poured it out before the Lord. He says, "I can't drink that." He says, "These men risked their lives for me. I'm not worthy of that kind of sacrifice." And he poured it out. He said, "This is only for the Lord." Now you compare that kind of leadership with our leadership today. Our politicians, as an example, you find it in the church as well. That kind of leadership today, where our politicians are saying, "You know, I need the best food, I need the best parties, I need the best vacations, I need the best..." The list continues. Who's paying for it? The people are sacrificing and making sacrifices for them. And they're taking it and indulging themselves with this and believing, "I am worthy of this." See, there's a romanticized view of leadership. Because I'm worthy of this kind of adoration. I'm worthy of this kind of attention to the detail, to fulfill my every whim. Oh, I feel like a vacation in some exotic place. I feel like this exotic meal. I want to listen to this exotic music group. Whatever it is, I can fulfill every whim of mine at the expense of others. You see, David said, absolutely not. This is complete contradiction of biblical leadership. The goal of manhood is not so that we might be able to indulge in all of the many fancied desires that the world may offer us, but rather to be about serving the needs of others with our might and our strength. Many regard strength, and unfortunately many husbands do this, men who are strong. They use their strength, and boys do it as well, who are becoming men and going to be men, but they use their strength in order to attain what they want. They can dominate, they can manipulate, they can organize the things with their strength. So they're using their strength to satisfy their desires. Whatever I desire, whatever fancy I want, I can use my strength to attain that, to achieve their every passion. Whereas the biblical view of strength is that it is used for advancing the well-being of others, for those weaker than yourself. You use your strength toward that end. That's why I'm strong. Okay, I've got this strength. I don't want to use this to flex and impress people. I want to use it for the building of the kingdom, for the advancing of the cause of Christ. You see, the romanticized view of manhood, it's everywhere. And it is, when I've got the position of authority, then I'll use my authority to satisfy my self-serving desires. Whereas what should be governing the thinking of men, whether old or young, is responsibility and kingdom purpose, which entails sacrificing self in order to attain these things. How do I attain these goals? Through self-sacrifice. The romanticized view of manhood sees it in terms of privileges and benefits. Whereas the biblical view sees it in terms of responsibilities. What are my benefits? What are my privileges I can have from this position? Whereas biblically it says, what are my responsibilities in this position? To whom much is given, much is required. And if you're a male, you've been given much in the sense of authority, position, strength. And therefore, because of these gifts, God expects us to produce much for Him. expects us to use these things to build his kingdom. This is certainly a legitimate application of the parable Jesus taught about the talents. If you remember, the man who had received one talent refused to multiply that talent. He said, no, this guy who's wanting me to increase the stuff for his own gain, this is immoral in my mind, this is wrong. He doesn't do any work, I'm doing the work, and he wants the increase. It's Matthew 25. That's what God has given us. He's given us strength, he's given us position, he's given us authority, and we're to see that as from his hand, that we need to take that and advance it. We need to multiply it. It needs to increase from one talent to two, to three, to four, whatever our skill and ability is able to do, but to increase it to that degree. So if you view yourself as that, okay, I'm a male, I'm going to have positions of authority, I'm going to have positions of responsibility and leadership, what is it for? It's for advancing the kingdom. We can perceive manhood in the same way as the wicked servant and despise the Lord that expects us to labor for him, or we can advance his purposes. What else is there to do? What else is there to do with what we have? Our position, whether it's in a family, whether it's your strength that you have. We can either use it for a momentary appearance, a flicker of fun from serving our own fantasies, our own self-centered passions, and our own agendas. There are ultimately only two options when it comes to embracing manhood. You either buy into the romanticized view or you embrace the biblical view. And you either live in terms of the romanticized view of manhood or you live in terms of the biblical view, but they're diametrically opposed to each other. This biblical manhood is committed to advancing the kingdom generationally. So it's self-sacrifice for the purpose of advancing the kingdom generationally. That's what it is. Not just, I want to take one step here. No, this is generational vision. And that needs to govern our thinking so that when we're planning and we're thinking, okay, how am I going to impact generationally? It has a generational vision and it sees itself as disposable for that cause. How can I have the most impact for the kingdom for generations to come? My limitations, my limited resources, my limited abilities, whatever it is, but how do I look at them and use them for a generational impact? What can I do now that will advance this cause? Now, children is the first obvious step. As you're thinking, okay, generationally, how do I have a great impact? Children is an obvious step. To be a husband and a father and pass on God's truth to your family, according to Psalm 78 and verse 4, which says, we shall not hide them from their children, telling to the generation to come the praises of the Lord and his strength and his wonderful works that he has done. John Calvin interprets this verse. He says, this verse teaches us the will of God, that these things should be published from age to age without interruption, so that being transmitted from father to child in each family, they might reach even the last family of man. Can you see there's even an evangelistic thrust in Calvin's thinking here of how this is going to spread, how the gospel is going to go forth. Now, it's not the exclusive evangelistic thrust, but there's a fundamental evangelistic and kingdom thrust in how he understands this verse. This is how it happens, this line upon line and laying it out. It's an important thrust in his thinking. It's a key pillar to Calvin's understanding of manhood, which is namely being a godly, biblically educated husband and father. You want kingdom impact? Kingdom momentum, you want generational advancement, this is it. Without generational vision, you become a potential hindrance to the kingdom because you get caught up living for the present, for yourself, without regard for what impact you will have for the kingdom generationally. My life becomes reduced to now. Scripture places much upon being committed to a generational impact for the kingdom. And central to having that kind of commitment is having children and instructing them in the Lord's ways. These are mighty weapons in God's hands, preparing arrows for battle, who will contend with the enemy in the gates, who will take on your vision, who will take on your kingdom principles and your desires, thrusting it forward into future generations. That's why eunuchs were men who could not produce seed and therefore could not have children, and so they were not allowed to assume positions of leadership among the Lord's people, because they had no real stake in the future generations. There was no real continuance and continuity with future generations. They were very now-centered, very localized. Even you get a faithful eunuch, but he wasn't tied to the future like people are who have children. As Deuteronomy 23 and verse 1 says, he who is emasculated by crushing or mutilation shall not enter the assembly of the Lord. And that was to assume a position of leadership in the Lord's congregation, so to speak. This contrast between the eunuch and the man whose quiver is full of arrows helps to define manhood. It helps to give us an image. Okay, manhood. Children are very inconvenient. They have a way of disrupting your life. turning things inside out and making things complicated. But here we have a picture that's defining for us manhood. Because what children do is knock you off your calm, predictable comfort levels that you become accustomed to. I can remember when I was studying at seminary and children hadn't yet arrived, and lying down on a Sunday afternoon for a rest and thinking, oh man, I'm going to miss this. I'm going to miss this rest. Children have a way of disrupting your life. A godly view of the family communicates the image of manhood that we ought to embrace. The essence of manhood is sacrificing self for the purpose of generational impact. How do we impact the most for generations to come? Vital to the sacrifice and having impact has to do with understanding God's truth and explaining His truth. We need to know the truth that God has revealed if we are going to effectively communicate it to our families and to others as opportunity arises. This doesn't mean that every man has to be a theologian, but it does mean we must commit ourselves to having a good grasp of the essential doctrines and be practiced in bringing every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. I've got to know what that looks like. What does it mean? How do I do this? And so, young men, God gave us a book and thus expects us to be familiar with that book. Reading it is important. And if you struggle to read, persevere. Because persevering to get on top of something that is important in God's kingdom is a demonstration of manhood. As hard as it is, as a struggle as it is, I encourage you to persevere. Get to grips with understanding the truth, vital for your effectiveness in the kingdom. As Paul said in 1 Corinthians 14 and verse 20, brethren, do not be children in understanding. However, in malice, be babes, but in understanding, be mature. I like the King James Version translation of that. It says, in understanding, be men, be full grown, be solid. And so we need to be challenged and encouraged by that, to be a mature person, to be a real man. In order to do that, our understanding about the truth must be mature. My father was not a well-educated man from a book-learning sense. He had to leave school when he was 13 and start working just because of their family circumstances. And so he never had a comprehensive... His training up to that point was also very basic. And he came to know the Lord later on in his life, and then even later on, he came to the Reformed faith and suddenly realized the importance of knowing true doctrine. And it was very humbling for me to look through his books after he died. And like he'd have Louis Burkhoff's Systematic Theology, which is a good fat book, and working his way through that. And yet every couple of sentences, or even sometimes in the same sentence, he would be stuck by, to my mind, would be a fairly straightforward English word. And he would then have to go and get a dictionary, look up the dictionary definition, try and understand the definition of the dictionary. He would write it in the margin because he wouldn't remember it, so he would want to come back and refer, so he would write the definition in the margin. And he would work his way just painstakingly, step by step, because he said, I've got to know these truths, I've got to understand this stuff. And he worked his way through that. I have some of his books still that I kept, but see these little notations that he's made on words that to me would... I wouldn't stumble at all upon them, but the reason I don't stumble on them is because of what he gave me. And so I had a better education than him. But it always sticks with me as a tremendous illustration of what manhood is and facing up to responsibilities as opposed to finding an excuse or blaming somebody. Woe is me. Do you know how hard my childhood was? You know, there was never anything like, do you know what my mother did? It was a matter of being a man and facing up to, this is my responsibility, I know what I have to do, and this is the situation I find myself in, therefore I've got to go forward in this situation. And so I'd encourage you to understand manhood in that same light, and you can leave. I mean, just that heritage that he left for me will have generational impact. That example, that showing to me, that's what manhood is. Manhood doesn't, not everybody's got an incredibly sharp mind, but don't be intimidated by that. God has still given us this book and said, guys, you can. And some guys, they can sit down and they can do a quick reading and everything sticks. And other guys will bumble and fumble through, but the objective is the same. The goal is the same in God's kingdom. And manhood is the same. All of life is not a smooth ride. Everything we do ought to be governed by the desire for having generational impact for the kingdom, which will help us discern and stand against the desire to serve ourselves and our fantasies. What do you want to do? What are you hoping to accomplish for the kingdom in doing that? What do you want to do? How is the kingdom going to be impacted by that? How will the kingdom be advanced through setting your heart upon whatever it is? Biblical manhood is meant to endure hardness as well. We've got to be tough to suffer for the kingdom. There's such a thing as godly war. Godly warfare is a biblical concept. And men are supposed to fight in wars. And that should alert us to the position of what God views as manhood. To endure difficulty, to suffer, to sacrifice self in the war context. Now, I'm not saying we necessarily going to face war, we might. But the picture of manhood still comes through in that understanding of war, of what it entails to be a man. War is not pretty, it's not romantic, it's hard and painful, it's heartbreaking. But what do? When people are dying around you, one on your left, one on your right, do you break down and stop the battle? You can't, you keep going. It's heartbreaking, but at the same time, there's endurance, there's a toughness, there's a hardness, there's a focus on the kingdom. This is the way we go, and we need to prepare our minds, our understanding toward that end, so that we're not tripped up on things that shouldn't really trip us up. Manhood entails being a man through every kind of extremity. And it's good to learn, a leader has no hatch that he can pull and escape through somewhere. He doesn't. He cannot stop life from moving. As a dad, you can't, you know, I'd like to just put things on hold here for a couple of weeks. This doesn't work. In any position of leadership, it doesn't work. Life is moving and it's God's design. And so we have to learn how to move in that, to deal with discouragement, to deal with disappointment, to deal with all kinds of obstacles and keep functioning in a leadership capacity and position. And our minds need to be hardened to that so that we understand that. And so when we meet against it, we know what our responsibility is. Okay, what's my responsibility? Well, one is I can just fall on the floor here and curl up into a little fetal position. Or two is my responsibility is I have to push forward. Yes, with God's grace and God's mercy, but that's what's required. And so we cry out to Him for His grace, we flee to Him, but we cannot disengage from life. Our weakness is real, but when we are aware of our weakness, that ought to drive us to Christ for His grace and His wisdom, so that we can be men as He has called us to be. Biblical manhood is no pleasure island cruise, and it's vital that we have our thinking brought into line with God's view about this. We are to be tough, courageous, and constantly sacrificing self for the advancement and the protection of others. If we don't learn how to endure hardness, we'll become complainers and shirkers. Is shirking a word that you understand? Escaping responsibilities. Getting out of what is required. Shirkers and complainers cannot be good leaders. So young men, don't think that one day when you reach a certain age, something will happen and then you will stop complaining. It's not going to happen. If you're a complainer as a young man, you will be a complainer as an old man. It will never leave you. It will stay with you. Because what you practice, that continues. And you strengthen yourself in whatever you practice. So if you practice complaining and shirking, that's going to follow you wherever you go. And people will have grand ideas about what they're going to accomplish. But really, it's going to be part of their imagination and not a part of reality. Bad habits need to be broken by practicing good habits. But this is hard and it requires diligence. It requires perseverance. There was a science teacher at school who came into class one day, this was my school, and he said, "What is intestinal fortitude?" And the real clever guy in the class came up with this elaborate scientific explanation. And the teacher said, "It's guts." That's what he wanted. And he was trying to encourage people to have intestinal fortitude. I think it's that the Japanese, they talk about putting iron in your stomach or iron in your belly. And that's quite a good picture, because sometimes when you feel just weak and washed out, you say, well, I've got to put iron in my belly. I've got to be strong. I've got to do what's necessary here. Competent leaders exert themselves more than those whom they are leading. Do you realize that? To be a leader, you're going to be expected to exert yourself more than those you're leading. If you think of the general commanding the forces, when the guys go and rest and he's still wrestling with the tactics, trying to find the information, trying to put the plan together, trying to work out on the strategy, he doesn't rest. Even if you break that down to a little guy who's leading a stick of men, a corporal, when they're marching through the bush and they stop to rest, the corporal doesn't rest. He's up, he's looking, he's plotting on the map, he's working out where they go from here. The other guys are just kind of sitting back, catching their breath. But the leader at that point is still working. He assumes that responsibility, he takes it upon himself. And so that understanding has to be in our minds. This is what leadership looks like. And so that we're not overcome by the fact that, why have I still got more work to do? Now, we're not talking about overextending as we talked last time. We talked about work last time. And so it's the balance of what work is and stuff. But we're workaholic as opposed to doing what is necessary. But we're not only to do what is easy. We are to do what is necessary. And what is necessary is defined by God's word. So biblical manhood can be summed up by two things. Two words, grace and guts. That can sum it up for us. Grace and guts to break old habits. Grace and guts to endure hardness. Grace and guts to train our children in God's ways. Grace and guts to show them how to do battle with the flesh, the world, and the devil. Without men, the kingdom will not move forward. And without a return to biblical manhood and an utter rejection of romanticized manhood, there will be no kingdom advancement in our days. May we embrace biblical manhood and be inspired by the challenge it lays before us to be real men, to be humble, to be utterly dependent upon the Lord's grace and truth, to be self-sacrificial, to be tough, to know how to endure hardness, to work harder than those we lead, to not be caught up in complaining, but to be cheerful and confident, and with an ever-increasing passion for generational impact. I want there to be impact generationally. How does that work? Let's prepare our hearts now so that we are genuinely prepared to lay our lives down for others, to stand boldly against all that would oppose the truth of our King, and to inspire those around us to faith and to good works. We cannot do this without the Lord, but this is what He has called us to do, and He has also provided all we need in order to accomplish that and to live our lives in this way. Biblical manhood is a glorious thing, and it's a privilege indeed, and has been for us, it's a great privilege to have been shouldered with the responsibilities, the massive responsibilities of being men in a biblical sense. May we be found faithful. May we be found to be men, real men, for the glory of the kingdom. May we embrace that, and may we truly follow that, and stand and see the glorious fruit and salvation of our God. Any questions or comments or further illustrations?
Fought in the battle of ideas in the culture to preserve their right and ability to implement that, and just to highlight that thought.
Mm-hmm. That's vital, that the importance of being engaged in tearing down the strongholds and anything that exalts itself against the name of Christ. That's part of our generational impact with our children. The impact of advancing the kingdom is fighting the battles on our doorstep. So the liberty of homeschooling, the liberty of worshipping how we want to worship, which could be encroached upon in many different fields shortly, from who is allowed to become a member in our church to what we are allowed to do within the church. So we need to realize that this encroaching thing is, it's more advanced in Europe, but the same mindset and mentality, while we have the present regime in power, is thinking on those same lines. And so the church is going to be challenged, and we need to be men to stand. Well, why don't we pray?